Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1442.NU1150, certificate number 37300. Worcestershire sauce.
We gotta use this one just shusha. I don't know.
All right, so now as an American from the far, far west, I have been told over the years, and as having traveled to England many times, I have been told that it is not pronounced Worcestershire sauce. The "shire" isn't even pronounced at all, and ultimately it's Worcester sauce. Am I right?
Partially, but not hugely.
All right. I should introduce you, Saul. Welcome to the show.
Hello, you're right.
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Are you, your accent is a little posh. Are you from the south?
I'm not.
Of the United Kingdom?
No. I'm from a very small, from a city in the northeast of England called Sunderland, which is where the chap who climbed up a battleship and hammered a flag into the mast was from. See previous episode. But most people from there do not sound like me in the slightest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I would assume that your fellow Northerners all have a much, what would you describe it as, harder accent or like a Northern accent?
Warm but intense. I mean, I can adopt the relevant accents if necessary. I think English people tend to tell me that I have a vaguely northern but somewhat posh sounding voice, which
I see the northern now that you're
getting,
you're
into
talking
it
a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But as someone who grew up on a council estate, or as you guys would say, a project,
project,
then I don't sound very much like my compatriots at school.
And where did the poshness come from?
I lived for a long time in a town called Harrogate in Yorkshire, which is quite a well-to-do town, and took on a lot of softer elements to my accent, let's say. I've lived away from home for far too long, and now I sound like the others.
And I'm right, though, that in England specifically, Britain more generally, your accent really is a determiner of how you're treated by others. Does it come into play in any kind of regular, when you go home, for instance, do people like cast aspersions?
Aspersions are definitely cast, but which is why I try not to go home very often. But yeah, I think I definitely sound very different from everyone else. But after about 10 minutes of spending time with what family I have that lives up there, then I have readopted quite a lot of my northeastern Macam accent, as it's called.
But so Worcestershire is not anywhere near where you grew up.
No.
It is, if I'm right, the ending shire means that it was a that was not a Norman part of Britain. It was a Saxon part of Britain. Oh, I've caught you out.
You have, yeah. To me, shires are it's the name of the county surrounding a place. So, like Yorkshire is the county that surrounds York, or Lincolnshire around Lincoln, and so on. Where it comes from a historical perspective, I'm not sure. I'm afraid I've let you down.
We that study maps, yep. You know, there's a line somewhere in Britain where all the place names on one side reflect the Vikings,
yeah,
and on the other side reflect the whatever.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of places in the southeast and the east aren't shires. There's fucks. So like Norfolk and Suffolk, and I'm not helping myself here. Then there's the sexes with Middlesex and Essex and Wessex and so on.
Right.
Yeah. And then the ones that don't have any particular suffix on the end that I can think of.
Yeah, I think Fook is is Viking, and Essex is, or yeah, right. That would be also Saxon. But anyway, blah, 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 blah. So tell me I don't usually allow co-hosts to correct my pronunciation because I never let Ken do it. But in this instance, I know that I'm doing it wrong. I mean, it's not like I didn't let Ken. Ken corrected it when he felt like it. But what is your pronunciation of Worcestershire?
this is one of the reasons why I suggested it, if not the main reason, was just to get you to say it wrong several times. Just because it's funny for me. I appreciate you falling into my amazing trap. It's Worcestershire.
It is Worcestershire.
Worcestershire, yeah.
So the Worcester part is right, but you actually do say the sure.
Yeah. Certainly to me, all of the English shire counties have a sh on the end. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so the sauce doesn't have a special shortening. You don't call it Worcester sauce. My mom calls it Worcester sauce.
Yeah. I'm not going to say people don't, and I'm not going to tell people that they can't, but I wouldn't personally. Okay. But, you know, I'm not going to yuck anyone's yum.
Well, so are you in the food line?
No. I've never particularly worked in food. I drink a lot of coffee, and I used to run a coffee company, but I've never worked in food in particular. I just, as I say, my main plan was to get you to say Worcestershire several times.
Well, that concludes this episode of The Omnibus. Let me put it another way. Is Worcestershire sauce a staple in British cooking?
It absolutely is, yeah. Yeah, it's used in quite a lot of recipes and on things like grilled cheeses and so on. I think my bottle has got a tiny, tiny, tiny amount left in, and I've had that about 2 years. So I'm getting through it.
Yeah. Grilled cheese?
Yeah,
that's
on
an
the top
abomination.
Of grilled cheese.
It's what delicious. Are you talking about? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
That never would have occurred to me to do, but I'm going to
try. You're
going to
do it now, yeah. Yeah.
Well, in my travels, one of the most surprising things was how zealously people in the UK will put Marmite on any kind of toast or bread. And it tastes like what you would find on the bottom of a shoe to me. Like it's vile, really.
On a particularly unpleasant walk, yes.
Right. Like if you were walking through a swamp that had also been once a factory, yeah. Maybe you would find Marmite. Like what is Marmite, and why is Marmite?
Marmite, I believe, is a byproduct of the brewing industry. So that was created place called Burton-on-Trent, where there's historically been a lot of breweries. It's just a yeast byproduct that some enterprising young scamp decided that they could probably find a use for it.
Is an industrial waste.
Yeah, once they discovered that it didn't make a very good adhesive for holding up wallpaper or made stamps taste awful, they decided just to sell it as a food product.
What is it in the peculiar cuisine, the legendary, world-famous cuisine of the United Kingdom? What is it about it that appeals to your taste?
I think the thing with Marmite is it's got a yummy umami flavor. It's quite punchy. I can take or leave it. The company that makes it likes to pretend that people either adore it or dislike it quite severely, which is fun to play into. But actually, I think most people are like, yeah, it's fine. It's a type of thing that can live in the back of a cupboard for a couple of years, completely forgotten, and then you'll go through a period of about 6 weeks where you'll just have it every day, and then it'll go back in the cupboard again.
Long-time listeners to Omnibus know how much we love Factor meals. They really are revolutionary. It's a kind of an entirely different take on easy-to-prepare, ready-to-eat meals. Quality. Perfect-sized portions, incredible ingredients. They've got meals with lean proteins, with colorful vegetables, whole food, healthy fat, no refined sugars, no artificial sweeteners, no refined seed oils. They're like a little meal that, I mean, not even little. They're like a meal that, as a bachelor, is so much better than I could create myself. It tastes like a restaurant meal, and it's ready in like micro minutes. It's astonishing what they're able to do with Factor meals. If you want to eat healthier, if you want to manage calories, if you want more protein, if you're on GLP-1s, if you've recently seen a documentary that touts the Mediterranean diet, if you want salads, every one of these is an option when you choose your Factor meals. And when they come, they will overwhelm you with how much better they are than you would expect. They also have a new Muscle Pro collection that supports strength and recovery. It's perfect if you're getting back into working out. These are always fresh, never frozen, ready in 2 minutes. 2 minutes. I challenge you to find another equivalent to Factor meals. No prep, no stress. Here's what I want you to do. Now, I'm serious now. I'm saying this for your own benefit. Go to factormeals.com/omnibus50off and use the code omnibus50off to get 50% off and a free breakfast for a year. This offer is only valid for new Factor customers with a code and qualifying auto-renewing subscription purchase. Make healthier eating easy today with Factor. That's factormeals.com/omnibus50off. And then use the code omnibus50off. Thanks, Factor.
And am I right that Worcestershire sauce is also an umami?
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. It gives you that big smack in the face kind of flavor. So it's kind of a combination of bitter and sour and sweet and umami and all of that yummy goodness that you want to put into other things, even though you wouldn't necessarily consume it on its own. Like you wouldn't neck a bottle of soy sauce. Well, I wouldn't neck a bottle of soy sauce. But yeah, so it gives you that nice round combination of flavors that adds in really well to some of the things that we are well known for and do very well, like pies and casseroles and things like that. Very, very, very big flavor hot, warm things to keep you happy on a cold, dark Victorian night.
Well, so break down the sauce.
Well, I wasn't sure which of the English counties you would be familiar with for a start, because I have heard suggestion that you've walked across Europe at some point, but you've
that's
not really
that
mentioned
heard that.
visiting England.
So I have. I've toured in England quite a bit, yep. Up and down the line, all the way up to, Edinburgh, but also past up. What's the very dark town in Scotland where it just seems like there are men in capes, like villains everywhere?
Aberdeen.
Yeah. Aberdeen.
I've played in Aberdeen as well. Yeah.
It's a phenomenal town, but I was there on a dark winter night. And I thought, what a place! Like, how could you not be a romantic poet living here? Yeah. It's just astonishing. And then all over Scotland, I think I've played every wide spot on the road in Scotland, and then the United Kingdom, multiple tours. And then I actually did. I walked from Heathrow to Harwich.
Is that on the coast?
Or to Harrow?
No,
Harwich. Right where
were
it was.
You off to catch a ferry? That's the only thing I know about Harwich. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
I was catching a ferry. And there's not really anything there except a ferry terminal.
Yeah, it's a good reason to leave.
Yeah, it was nice. But I was also often, mostly on the coast in the winter, where the colorful tents and the mods fighting rockers just weren't, it didn't translate to the winter, where it seemed really dark and wet and empty.
Yeah. When you're looking out towards the sea and you can't differentiate between where the sea finishes and the fog begins and the clouds begin, then it's, yeah, that's a traditional British seaside view, really. It's, you know, most of our postcards are covered in things like that.
Okay, so back to the sauce.
Back to the sauce, yeah. So, yeah, I wasn't sure... as I said, like whereabouts in England you might have been. I presume you've not been to Worcester.
I've been through Worcester on the way to Birmingham.
Yeah.
But we never played there. We played in Wolverhampton.
Okay. That's similarly located, isn't it?
My father's family comes from Newport, Wales, or in the environs.
Yes.
And my mother's family comes from sort of around Exeter. So, southwest, but not in the middle there.
It's close enough without being on top of.
All right.
Yeah, let's go with that. So, yeah, I mean, as I say, I picked Worcester. Now you've got me doing
Aha!
it. Now you've got
Aha!
me doing it.
Aha!
I picked Worcestershire sauce in order to get you to make the mistake that I just made then. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about English counties, and I'll stick with that for a minute, is if you ask a lot of people in the UK how many states are there in America, then everyone knows, subject to that number changing in the next 6 months, up or down, depending on moods. But actually, if you ask people in the UK how many counties there are in England, people tend not to know.
I see.
Yeah, and I find that fascinating. And I want to, at some point, visit all of the English counties, which will take substantially less time than visiting all of the American states. And yet, I've not got very far on that list.
You could almost do it on foot.
It sounds like the type of thing that you would very much do on foot. Yes, absolutely. But it's the type of thing I would do with some kind of wheeled transport.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it is very doable just based on how many places that I've been in the UK, but of course I had reason to go there. People were going to pay me £50 to play for 2 hours and drive all the way across the country and sleep on the floor of a wet hotel, which was a lot of enticement when I was young. How is it that you have grown to ripe middle age without having at least like taken a long weekend and driven out to Johnnegroats or whatever.
I have visited a lot, you know, a good portion, but there's a big swathe of the south of England that us northerners, we need extra visas for and stuff like that. So it's quite a process and a rigmarole to kind of go through. So it's just not that tempting. And once you've found nice places, it's always nice to go back to them, isn't it? So I think it's that laziness that comes with that kind of thing.
Okay, so back to the sauce.
Yeah, so sauces. So obviously you've already cast aspersions upon British cooking, so I appreciate that. It saves me having to do it. So I don't get.
I think that's one thing that everyone in the world agrees upon. It's a thing that unites the people of the United States. Nobody will defend British food. Although I love a traditional English breakfast. I think it's one of the great plates of mush that exists in the world.
It's great, isn't it? Worcester is in as we've kind of discussed it, it's kind of slightly to the west and south of Birmingham. And it's a place that apparently is famous for many things. I looked these up and everything. It was on the Royalist side during the English Civil War, and was the host of both the first and the final battle of the Civil War in different places. Yeah, so Liam Perrins is the company for which Worcestershire sauce is most kind of connected. And I know that they sell Liam Perrins You've done it to me, John. Liam Perrins Worcestershire sauce is available in America and in apparently over 130 countries around the world. Really caught on. For a country that doesn't know how to cook stuff, we can make ingredients that people will use all over the place.
How many of those 130 countries at one point or another suffered under the jackboot of British colonialism? 128 of them?
I was going to say there are at least three that didn't. Yeah, so I'm going one better than you.
That Liam Perrins just came with the pith helmet. It was tucked into the pith helmet and brought all around the world.
Very much so. And there's a few stories around that I can share in a minute, which will be helpful. But the Worcestershire sauce is kind of got a very mixed backstory to it. So that they say themselves that it was created in 1837, but there was quite a lot of pre-existing sources that kind of go back both in England and internationally. So even the Romans had something quite similar. So Romans and the Greeks and the Phoenicians had garum, which was a very umami packed sauce that was made from fermented fish and wines and other things just thrown in there, but again very similar sounding flavors to it. But Worcestershire sauce itself, as I say, was invented by Liam Perrins in 1837, and they were pharmacists. So much like the Coca-Cola Pepsi tradition of we're pharmacists but we also like to mess about and throw lots of ingredients in things and see what happens, they did something similar. So, but I think the company themselves do tell a story that claims that the recipe was created at the request of a baron who'd previously been the governor of Bengal, talking about our jackbooted Commonwealth friends.
So he missed the cuisine of South Asia.
Yeah. And wanted to bring some of that back with him. So he gave them a recipe that he'd brought back with him from Bengal. This is their story, at least, and asked them to make it. But when he tasted it, it wasn't very nice at all. So they shoved it in the basement, as is the best thing to do with huge quantities of liquid that you're unsure what to do with. True. I mean, that's where all of my strange liquids live. And then 18 months, 2 years later, they remembered that this barrel was in there and they went and tasted it and discovered that actually now it's all of a sudden really nice because it's had time to ferment and build the flavor profiles and so on. By 1843, it was so successful that it was being put onto ships by pursers as part of their regular supply of condiments and so on. So within 5 or 6 years, it was already being transported across the world on ships as part of their regular supplies. So it was really successful very, very, very quickly, and was finding itself very quickly transported across the world, as I say, as part of the manifest, but also something that they sold in a lot of places. So they, being good pharmacists, they didn't just rely on one product. They were able to, in 1849, they had supplies that were going alongside the California Gold Rush. There was a ship that was abandoned. The ship goes unnamed, unfortunately, by history. The inventory list included case of Worcestershire sauce, as well as Liam Perrin's other products, including medicine and medical trusses.
Oh, trusses.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that explains the popularity of trusses here in California. Now, was Liam Perrin's sauce, did it also have components where it staved off scurvy, or... Is it rich in some sort of vitamin or other kind of min?
I think it is. It probably is quite healthy. Whether or not it is as healthy as they make out, I'm unsure. For a lot of the 19th century, it was marketed for its health benefits, and was apparently described as having. Now, this is a word I'm unfamiliar with. Stomachic. Stomach, I see. Stomachic. Stomachic?
Stomachic?
Stomachic and digestive properties.
So it was a patent medicine in addition to being
a handy thing for turtle stew. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, there is a strong history in the UK of brown sauces that were available at the time, which included... The poet Byron, out of the poet Byron fame, mentioned it in a poem in 1817. I looked up the poem, and it basically just seems like he's sending a shopping list to someone.
was it later just misinterpreted as a poem? But in fact, it was.
It's entirely possible. So they one of the precursors, and there were a few of them. To Worcestershire sauce was Harvey's sauce, which was goes back to at least the 1790s. And Byron mentioned it in 1817. And it says, thereby humbly I would recommend the curious in fish sauce before they cross the sea to bid their cook or wife or friend walk or ride to the strand and buy in gross, and then it just suddenly turns to a shopping list: ketchup, soy, chili vinegar, and Harvey's. Or by the Lord, a Lent will well nigh starve ye.
It really makes the heart sore, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, I don't want to describe anyone as being overrated based on a few lines.
Okay, so back to the sauce.
Yeah, so it's been for a very long time used as an ingredient in things, and there's a reference to it from a cookbook that goes back to 1912, which was written by the Portland, Oregon Council of Jewish Women, which had no less than 35 recipes in which Worcestershire sauce was an ingredient. What was Portland like in 1912? Do you know?
Well, it was lumber was its primary industry, and then to a lesser degree, you know, fishing off the coast. I think there might have been some coal, but it was mostly a lumber town and pretty rough and tumble.
Yeah,
I just looked up the Portland Council of Jewish Women, and it was established in 1896, and it made it all the way to 2015.
Back to the sauce.
Back to the sauce.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've got a couple more examples of products that Messrs. Lee and Perrins created. That they created the infamous essence of coffee.
Go on.
That's all I know about it. it's an essence of coffee.
That you would add to, like, food?
Who knows? Who knows? The internet provides a name, but no description of what it is. They also produced because, perhaps because people had questions about the essence of coffee, they made something called Taraxacum. Taraxacum is a dandelion coffee. For those of you who don't like coffee in your coffee, then you could try dandelion coffee.
Wouldn't it be dandelion tea, which is a thing we've all heard of?
I think that they're really just like the word coffee. And it's got a bit more of a continental flair to it. Maybe that's where they were coming from. Although perhaps not, but we'll get into that in a second. And the final product that they created and were selling that I've got here is Dr. Locox lotion for the growth of the hair.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Did that also... was it also like a yeast-based potion that sat in a basement and then people realized it made hair grow on their hands?
Perhaps so, yeah. So perhaps that's why coffee didn't get adopted quite as much in the aristocracy in the UK, but I am making things up out of my head rather than basing any of those on facts.
No, that seems right, and it's also very consistent with Omnibus's... that's within our purview. Yeah. That's part of our charter, even.
Very much so.
Now, here's a gross fact. I know Omnibus listeners love gross facts. Traditional bed sheets hold more bacteria, or can hold more bacteria, depending, than a public toilet. Isn't that astonishing? It's not exactly where you want to lay your face. But miracle-made bedding is designed to fight bacteria and stay cleaner longer with silver-infused fabrics that actually prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. Miracle-Made sheets, as longtime listeners know, are crafted with NASA-inspired silver-infused fabric that helps regulate your body temperature, and thanks to antibacterial silver technology, they stay cleaner and fresher, but even better, they feel luxuriously good. They're better than sheets that you would find at a 5-star hotel, but without the steep price tag. They're smooth, they're breathable, very silky, they're ridiculously comfortable. So if you don't want your bed to be like a gross porta potty, I suggest you upgrade your sleep, and you can also give the gift of upgraded sleep by going to trymiracle.com/omnibus to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use the promo code Omnibus, you'll get an extra 20% plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and they have a 30-day money-back guarantee. There's no risk to you to go to trymiracle.com/omnibus. Enter the code Omnibus at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. When hair starts to thin, confidence can too. That's why Hims makes it simple to feel like yourself again with access to simple, personalized care that fits your life and your hair goals. Hims offers convenient access to a range of prescription hair loss treatments with ingredients that work, including chews, oral medications, serums, and sprays. These are doctor-trusted ingredients like finasteride and minoxidil, and they can stop further hair loss and regrow hair in as little as 3 to 6 months. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. So for simple online access to personalized and affordable care for hair loss, erectile dysfunction, weight loss, and more, go to hims.com/omnibus. That's HIMS, hims.com/omnibus for your free online visit. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information. Individual results may vary based on studies of topical and oral minoxidil and finasteride. Go to hims.com/omnibus And thank you, Hymns, for supporting our show.
Oh, what else were we going to say? I've got so many bits of paper here. Oh, yeah, I was going to talk a little bit about Messrs. Lee and Perrin themselves, or Perrins, which is a weird thing to have a plural surname. But they were both pharmacists in Worcester, one of whom, Mr. Lee, went on to have quite a established life in the civil society of Worcester. So he was twice mayor of Worcester, which was, you know, quite a significant achievement, I guess, especially mm-hmm. for someone who was, in essence, a shopkeeper. Yeah, and I seem to recall, but my bit of paper doesn't say, that it was, you know, almshouses specifically for people who had been in the military, you know.
Oh.
Veterans, that's the word.
There you go.
Whereas Mr. Perrin's, his main claim to fame was that he invented Worcestershire sauce. I don't know if you've heard of it at all.
And then he faded into obscurity. He didn't become mayor, or
he didn't become mayor or anything else. But I do have a quote actually from one of the later Lord Sandys, for whom they claimed, you know, whom they claimed had led an inspiration, if nothing else. Apparently, he said that he would like a share in the proceeds if his family had helped to create it, to which they responded that he might have a share in the profits if he would stand behind the counter and assist in its sale.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
Oof.
That told him.
Yeah, I guess so. That's how you treat the rich,
it is,
right?
Yeah. You tell them to get behind the counter and do some bloody work.
That's right.
That's how I would do it. So, yeah, I mean, it's I don't know how much extra you've learned about Lee and Perrin so far. So we have a very different packaging to you guys. I've seen the American version of the packaging, which seems rather different. We've got this nice snazzy version, which has got their signature in the background, which apparently was introduced to combat copycats. And to combat people who were making fraudulent versions. Quite what would stop anyone who was making a fraudulent version from just copying their signatures and putting it on the label is beyond me. But
my recollection of it growing up was that Lee and Perrin's, unlike other sauces, came wrapped in sort of a paper wrapper that looked very Victorian. It looked... This was kind of a special presentation. Now, when I look at the contemporary Lee and Perrin's logo, it just has the word steak on it, which is weird. But we do typically use it on steak,
right?
As a flavoring. But the old label, the label that I remember from the 70s and 80s, did look, if not as fancy as yours, it did look very...
like it had been hand-wrapped by an apothecary.
Yeah, it did. It seemed like a special thing. And, of course, Worcestershire being a long word, Americans tend to shorten long words because we're very busy.
Yeah.
And we don't have the time to figure out why it is that the Sester part of Worcestershire... is almost entirely excised, but it did, you know, it seemed like, oh, wow, this has survived the wars, this thing.
Many of them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And so, but is it also a steak sauce in the UK?
No. I don't.
You put it on grilled cheese sandwiches.
We put it on grilled cheese sandwiches. We put it into things, but I wouldn't. When peppercorn sauce exists or mayonnaise exists, why would you?
You know, the steakhouse was a big part of the 20th century. The sense of, you know, if you were going to a business meeting or it was a significant night out, here you would go to the steakhouse, and the menu was confined to steak and boiled vegetables and maybe a fish or a lobster of some kind. But it wasn't a restaurant like we see now where you can get a pasta and you can get nachos. It's still here in Seattle. There are a dozen steakhouses, and every one of them, at least until recently, had Leon Perrin's Worcestershire sauce on the table. And I guess the idea is you put it right on top of your steak.
Wow.
As far as I could, I mean, my experience is that it's such a powerful sauce that it seems like a sauce that you would use to mask bad steak rather than to enhance good steak.
Yeah. Do you have mustard there usually
as
well?
But we wouldn't put it on a steak.
You wouldn't have mustard on a steak?
No, not at all. I mean, you might put mustard in, like a little bit of mustard in a sauce that you would then glaze a steak before you fired it. But you would, no one has ever, in my experience, put mustard directly on a steak.
Fair enough.
On a sausage.
Yes.
But not a steak.
You said that it was is something that lasts. I have a prime example of that for you. Some archaeologists who were digging in a town in New Zealand, in a town called Te Wairoa. My New Zealand pronunciation isn't great, I'm afraid. That town had been buried in a volcanic eruption in the 1880s. And in their digging, they found a preserved bottle of Worcestershire sauce.
So do you feel now that that Worcestershire sauce is like one of the main English contributions to global cuisine? Because umami we think of as coming from Japan, and we use a lot of soy and other kind of fish sauces from Asia. But we all still, everywhere you go, still has Liam Perrins. Like what could be behind this like lasting influence? Is there nothing else like it?
There are similar things. So obviously soy sauce is quite similar, and unexpectedly it turns out that for a very long time soy sauce was one of the key ingredients in Worcestershire sauce, which is ironic because in the late 19th century there were scurrilous rumors that soy sauce was made from crushed black beetles, and Liam Perrins hopped onto that and did an advertising campaign saying that Liam Perrins is a safe British sauce that can be used instead of that horrible foreign muck, because we're a big fan of jingoistic xenophobia in this country. So yeah, they were quick to jump on that, but very quiet on the, actually that's an ingredient we use, so could you not speak badly of it?
Because soy is a Chinese food, and it would have been part of that global trade of the 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, tamarind is a really key ingredient of Worcestershire sauce as well. And I presume that tamarind is from India originally, but I'm unsure. And that's one of the key differences between it and the kind of predating brown sauces. None of those seem to have included tamarind, which gives it a bit more of a slight spiciness to the flavor as well. And I think also helps to echo the predominant British cuisine that we have nowadays, which is curry, obviously.
Right, Indian food.
Yeah.
All of the best food I've ever had in the UK is from India. But what blew me away the first time was that curry is a street food, cheap and oily and you know, omnipresent, whereas here Indian food is a cuisine that tends to be fairly expensive, and you go out to dinner where you get Indian food, and it is a whole kind of experience, and they have, you know, the restaurants are, it's now you can get it delivered, but it is absolutely not a takeout kind of working man's lunch food like it is in the UK. So it's it was very surprising to me that you could get it cheaply. It was so delicious, and it was, you know, it was like a working class food. Yeah. Whereas here, it's very much the opposite.
Incredibly readily available. We've very much adopted it as maybe second behind roast beef as our national dish.
And that concludes Worcestershire sauce. Entry 1442.NU1150. Certificate number 37300 in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, we're very much against social media here. It seems more and more likely that what you're seeing on social media is just bots that are being run out of a warehouse in St. Petersburg, and they're meant to make you feel upset or angry or sad. And the only safe place, really, that I can find on the internet now is anywhere on social media where futurelings congregate, because they're among the last real people. And you know that if you're in the safe space where people are able to say back to the sauce to one another, then you know you're safe from Russian influence at least for a while. You can join us at Omnibus Project on Facebook and Instagram. I have now recently been frequenting the communities on Reddit and Discord. And every one of these places is just full of, I have to say, geniuses, absolute geniuses, with a lot of social grace. You can watch this episode and all of the Omnibus 2.0 episodes on YouTube at youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. You can email us, and I encourage you to do it, at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Visit our website, omnibusproject.com, and you can submit, as Saul did, submit a topic, hopefully not a topic where the larger premise is just to get me to mispronounce words, at omnibusproject.com/submit. You can send us physical mail to the Omnibus Project, 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, that's Burien, 98166-9998. And finally, our show is listener-supported, and especially now that the millionaire co-host has taken all of his filthy lucre and bought a vacation house for himself where he has a helipad. Your support is welcome, and we also have many, many great goods and cheese over on our Patreon site, including like 8 years worth of addenda episodes, or no, maybe only 6 years worth of addenda episodes featuring the great Ken Jennings, and lots of photographs and lots of other additional material. So that's at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Go join the Futurelings there at any level of contribution, and you'll have access to almost all of the additional material. And I think at slightly larger levels of donation, you get to have special merch. And I'm considering a level of Patreon support where you get to co-host the addenda show as a perk.
Ooh.
I think that would be expensive, though. I haven't decided exactly how to do it. You know, you'd have to, you're like somebody that supports the show enough that I would have you on and have you like, whoa, what was that? You literally have a gong.
It's this microphone stand has got springs on it. I just knocked a spring. I'm very sorry.
Wait. No, that's all right. That was fantastic. You should have been doing that throughout the whole episode.
I can get my marimba out. Again,
that is patreon.com/omnibusproject. Please join the legions that support the show. And it keeps me from living in an almshouse. And so, Saul, before we go, I'm trying to include the co-host's sort of other interests in our outro. Have you got anything coming up? Have you written a book on sauce, or are you engaged in alms for the poor? What have you got in your near future?
Well, I'm a comedy performer.
Congratulations! Talk about degenerate.
But I'm one of the nice ones. So I'm also on the board of something called the Live Comedy Association in the UK, which is a charity that promotes grassroots comedy and helps to lobby government and funders to make sure that comedy isn't overlooked when it comes to funding opportunities and support from the government and lots of other things like that. And we've got something called Live Comedy Day, which is happening on the 1st of April this year, where we'll be having lots of comedy events across the country, just helping to raise the profile of more grassroots comedy rather than the high profile arena type shows or big theatre shows that usually capture everyone's imagination. It's just really about reminding people throughout the country that comedy exists in all forms, on stage, and encouraging people to go along, so people can find more about that through various internet engines that will allow them to find out things.
And so what's it called again?
It's
on April 1st?
Live Comedy Day.
And do you also celebrate April Fool's Day?
That's why we chose that day.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. Well done. Well done.
Thanks.
Well, one of the main differences we think of culturally between the UK and Europe and the United States, well, this is true even of Canada, is that you still have functional arts support in those places, whereas the United States has almost entirely gutted any sort of government support for the arts. At the state and county level, we still support the arts.
Yeah.
But the National Endowment for the Arts has not been very well endowed by our government since the Reagan administration. So that's marvelous that you're making, you're trying to raise awareness that comedy is not actually something that should be banished from the face of the earth.
And it's not something
arguable.
It's not just something that exists on Netflix as well, you know, that encouraging people to go out and find out what's on near them as well. And in the UK, comedy isn't considered an art form, which is something that we're trying to amend, because that would create more opportunities for funding, but also tax breaks and things like that for some of the smaller venues to help them survive in more challenging times.
We do here in the US think of comedy as the comedy industry, entertainment industry, is maybe not quite at the level of the music business, but really we do consider it, you know, an art form.
Yeah, I'd also encourage people to find out about my own little podcast that involves me reading out from a phone book, which they can find out by visiting saulhenry.com.
I wish we could dig more deeply into that, but I'm going to let futurelings discover your phone book reading podcast on their
own. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all of our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we will wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in The Omnibus.